Welcome to New Books and Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. Edith Piaf was a singer and cultural icon, as well as one of France's biggest international stars. Today I'm going to be talking with Carolyn Berg about her Piaf biography entitled No Regrets. Hi, Carolyn. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books and Biography today to discuss No Regrets. I'd like to kick things off by just having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me in the first place. I'm a bit of a hybrid as a biographer. I was born in Sydney, Australia, where I lived as a child, came to the U.S., and did my schooling here, and went to Paris as soon as I could at age 19, and have been going back there ever since. So that's decades. I first discovered my beloved Edith Piaf when I was living in a maid's room up on the sixth or seventh floor of the building in Paris where I found lodging at the time, and I listened to her on the radio very frequently and indeed learned French by singing along with her.
So what drew you to her story?
First of all, her voice. It was so powerful. It just knocked my socks off. I've never heard anything like it before. You have to think that this was in the late 50s, and I had come from the U.S., where we had quite interesting and lively music, but nothing in any way sounded like what Piaf was singing. It was the passion in her voice, the go-for-broke quality, that just amazed me. And then when my French teacher at the Sorbonne, where I was studying, happened to say that if you were looking for a good example of excellent French pronunciation and diction, you would do well to listen to Edith Piaf. And I thought, good heavens, all right, I'm doing the right thing. So I had that sense of identification with the culture through her and through my early times in Paris. Then when I was looking for another subject recently after I'd finished my previous book, I thought, well, I really want to go back to Paris, and this is going to provide me the opportunity. And besides, you know, she's so much a part of my imagination. I want to do Edith Piaf, but I had to nerve myself up to it because she was so famous, and I hadn't written about anyone of that stature before.
What was the writing process like? Were you in Paris for that?
A part of it. I spent as much time as I could in Paris, which amounted to a few months each year. And mostly when I was in Paris, I was interviewing people who had known her or were part of her extended musical family, or I was going to the French National Library to read old newspapers, things like that. So I did more research and kind of digging around, including at flea markets, to find old magazines with features about her when I was in Paris. And then when I came back to California, where I live, my suitcase is full of all this treasure. I would sift through and sit down and decide what I was going to do next. So it was a kind of a slightly interrupted writing process, but it seemed to flow very well.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to write the book?
This was the fastest book I've done of my three so far. 3 years flat. I think I was more or less inhabited, if we can say that. I'm translating from the French, by the pace at which Piaf herself lived. As you know, she had a very short life, and she lived at an incredible breakneck pace. She really wore herself out in the end. But I was writing in some way, I think, in retrospect, in her rhythm, because it was the kind of life it was. I had to write it to feel it that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. What sources did you find most helpful as you were writing?
Several different kinds. To begin with, the wonderful Piaf collectors. I had never encountered fans before as a source of information and documents, but I met several of Piaf's fans and collectors of anything to do with her and her life. While I was in France, in particular, two men in Marseille who have the largest collection in the world of what we might call Piafiana, and I went to visit them several times. We hit it off. We realized that we were so much on the same wavelength that we could really work together well, although they were doing their book and preparing exhibitions. It was fine. My work was complementary. So that was one kind of new source. They had, for example, unpublished interviews that they had taped with her when she was still alive, and they had obscure recordings and posters and everything down to her her automobile, which I got to ride in. They have the most extraordinary collection. This was very inspiring to be with such people who are kind of living and breathing in the atmosphere of Edith Piaf. Then on the opposite extreme of research, the Bibliothèque Nationale of the French National Library has many wonderful collections, but two in particular were very important to me. The first was a big, big cache of Piaf's correspondence with the man she called her spiritual mentor, whose name was Jacques Bourgeat. She wrote to him over some 30 years, because he really was her teacher and guide during much of that time. These were the most personal, intimate letters that gave so much new information and a fresh way of seeing her from within, in a sense. They hadn't been available before, so I was the first person to be able to use them and quote from them in English. And that was a wonderful, wonderful discovery for me.
Early on in No Regrets, I think it's the first paragraph of the preface, you use the word feral to describe Piaf. And it caught my attention at the time before I even read the book, and it kind of stuck with me throughout because it's such an extraordinarily vivid word. Why do you think this is applicable to her?
Well, because she was such a wild child. She was a child of the streets who was schooled chiefly in survival until she met this Jacques Bourgeat at the age of 20. She had minimal schooling of a formal kind, and mostly she learned on the fly, on the go, as she traveled with her father, who was a traveling acrobat and contortionist. The two of them traveled around France to provincial towns and just did enough, you know, did performances in the streets to earn enough to survive from day to day, which is a pretty wild or feral existence for a little girl starting at age 7. So that's part of what I meant. There's more, but that's the beginning.
Can you talk a bit about her life in the Paris slums and how she grew up?
Yes, certainly. Her parents were street performers. As I said, her father, absolutely fascinating character, about 5 feet tall, and a contortionist and acrobat who must have put on a very good act. You know, he could perform all kinds of amazing tricks, but did them for whatever passers-by felt like contributing. Her mother was a would-be singer and sometimes street singer, as Edith was too, but the mother abandoned the family when Edith was an infant and went off on her own. She wasn't cut out to be a mother, I guess. So Edith's early childhood was extremely dramatic, we would say, perhaps. She was brought up partially by her maternal grandmother, who was, I think, drunk much of the time. And then when her father came back from serving in World War I and saw the conditions in which his little girl was living, he took her off to his mother, her paternal grandmother, who lived in a small town in Normandy, all of which sounds great, but it just so happens that the grandmother ran the town's brothel. So Edith then lived in the private family quarters of the town's brothel until her father came and took her away after the local priest said to him and maybe to the grandmother, look, this can't go on. You can't bring up this little child in a brothel. It was a pretty remarkable start to life, but didn't seem to bother her. She was a person who could just take things in stride and respond to whatever came her way, pretty much, until she became quite ill in later life. So it's a picturesque upbringing, to say the least.
Yes.
And she also had health problems from a young age because she was nearly blind while she was at
That's
the brothel, right?
Yes. The reason that she could stay at the brothel, in a sense, was that she couldn't, they could tell themselves, the adults, that she couldn't see what was going on because she had a very bad case of keratitis, which is now curable with antibiotics, but they didn't have them then. So a lot of the time, her eyes were almost closed, and she had to be treated with cold water compresses. So people could think, well, she doesn't really know what's happening. But when she was finally cured, and she thought that her cure came thanks to St. Teresa, because the grandmother and the ladies of the house all went to St. Teresa's shrine nearby in Lisieux, and prayed that little Edith might recover her sight. And then the wonderful story is that indeed, you know, in the short time she did. After that happened, it was then that the curé apparently said, look, you can't bring up this child in these circumstances. So off she went with her father in his circus caravan, which was quite a shift, but no less dramatic, shall we say.
How did she begin singing?
Oh, well, her father noticed that she had a good voice and had her sing at the end of his performances, maybe one or two songs, when she went around collecting coins from the passers-by. And I suppose he realized quite quickly that she had a major talent. So he incorporated her into the act and had her sing. But I learned from the people in that little town in Normandy where her grandmother lived that she was already singing even before her father came and took her off with him on his travels. So it must have been noticed that this child had an incredible voice very early on.
What types of songs did she sing?
Oh, well, at first she sang, there's some dispute about this because she said several different things about what she sang. You have to think that this was at a time just after World War I, and there was a lot of, you know, patriotic sentiment. She said that she sang the Marseillaise, the French national anthem. But at another time, she also said that she sang the International, the Communist International. So it would be interesting to know what she actually sang first, or if she sang both, but that doesn't particularly matter. She also sang very sentimental, romantic, popular tunes, which were not suitable to her age at all. But no doubt this drew the audience, because the contrast between this, you know, sweet-looking little girl and the kind of naughty lyrics that she was singing, or suggestive lyrics, would have been quite striking. So she learned the popular repertoire of the day. And when she went off on her own at age 15, when she decided she'd had enough of her father and his new wife and her new siblings, she went off to sing in the streets by herself in Paris. So she sang the popular repertoire of the singers of the day, including lots of songs that were called chanson réaliste, or realistic songs about working class people's lives. Romances, too, of course.
Mm-hmm. And shortly after she went off on her own, she had her first major love affair with Louis Dupont, right?
Yes. And she had a baby who, they were not married, but that didn't particularly matter. In their milieu, lots of people didn't marry. So for a time, they would, as we say, shacked up together and tried to make a go of it as a little family. But that didn't last too long.
Right. And then he wound up with their child for a while, and she went to Piguel. Can you talk a bit about her time performing in Piguel and what Piguel was like in that time?
Oh, yes. I love doing this research and writing this part of the book, because Piguel was, without a doubt, the most edgy, saucy, dangerous, and exciting part of Paris at the time. We're talking in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And it was, among other things, the home to both the French mafia and naturally some of their related trades like prostitution and rackets and other things. So Edith and her girlfriend, who accompanied her at the time, ended up living in a little hotel, cheap little hotel rooms, right in the heart of all that. And Edith had to work out a way to not get taken up by some of these gangster types that they were hanging out with in the expected way, that is, as a streetwalker, but rather to get them to honor her abilities as a street singer. It was quite an amazing time, but she really learned to trade because she had to figure out how to survive in these very rough circumstances, how to have enough protection and enough independence, a very, very tricky balance.
Yeah. How did she come by her stage name?
Ah, well, that's a wonderful story. This is how it goes. When she was not quite 20, she and her friend decided that they would venture out from Pigalle and sing in some of the more prosperous areas of Paris. You have to think, of course, that Paris was very much kind of a socially divided city with slummy areas, dangerous areas, middle-class areas, and upper-class areas. So they decided very sensibly to go where the money was. And this particular day in the autumn of, I think it was 1935, they went off to sing near the Champs-Élysées. Edith was singing on a street corner near the Arc de Triomphe when a well-dressed gentleman came over and listened for a while, and then when she stopped, said to her, "You must stop singing like this. You'll ruin your voice. You're belting out the music." To which she replied, "Well, I have to earn a living." This man turned out to be Louis Leclerc, who owned a very fashionable little nightclub cabaret nearby. And he, recognizing her talent, said, "Well, look, come and audition for me." That was how she got her start, and he paid her so much more than, you know, for a night than she could earn in a week that she was absolutely amazed. And from then on, she didn't have to perform in the streets because she developed a calling. Now, her name, you asked me about. She was born as Edith Gassion, which didn't sound too good. And Le Play, this nightclub owner, said, "Well, look, I've got to find you a stage name. I would like to call you... I would like to give you the name that you deserve, which is, you know, Street Sparrow. But this one is taken. The word for sparrow, moineau in French, was already taken. Somebody else was using it." So he said, "I'll call you Edith Piaf," Piaf being slang for sparrow. So that was how she got the name, and it stuck with her from then on, Edith the Sparrow.
It's so appropriate that it was the slang word.
Oh, yes, it's perfect. No, it is, because it's a poor little bird that pecks out its living with difficulty in the street. So it was just right.
What role did Raymond Asso play in her rise to fame?
Oh, he's another really interesting character. I like him a lot. He lived in Pigalle. He wrote songs. He composed the lyrics for a number of popular songs in the mid-30s when she was just beginning to establish herself. And he had admired her from afar, but she never particularly took to him until after the first tragedy in her life, which was the murder of Louis Leclerc, her impresario, the man who had taken her off the street, so to speak, and into his nightclub. Well, she found herself... with the ruins of a career not long after she had really made her start, because the police and the popular press wanted to associate her with this murder, although she had nothing to do with it. And one day when she came back from touring the south of France to realize that, you know, she was never going to go anywhere with all of these suspicions hanging around her unless she found someone else to help her, she phoned Raymond Asso and said, "Can you come and help me?" This was about 37, 38. From that point on until the Second War, they were a couple. He wrote for her. He composed songs on the basis of the stories that she told him about her life. They were really collaborators in a way. And at the same time, he said he tamed her. We're coming back to the feral issue. When he found her, he thought she was so wild that he wanted to civilize her, to teach her better manners, how to behave in society if and when she might find herself with middle class or upper middle class people, to teach her better diction and to, in general, smooth some of the rough edges, which he did. And he wrote some wonderful songs for her.
Yeah. This is a bit of a change of direction, but one of the things that really surprised me throughout No Regrets was her mystical bent, her spiritualism. And she preferred private devotion to institutionalized ritual, but she was seen like darting in and out of churches often and prayed regularly. Can you discuss the role of spirituality in her life?
Yes, it's very, very interesting. This is new, too. It's been known that she always wore a medal for St. Teresa, who had performed the miracle, so she thought of curing her blindness. But in general, people haven't taken too seriously the spiritual dimension in her life. She was very much drawn to worship, but not in a conventional way. In other words, she didn't go to church on Sundays that much, but she would, as you said, pop into a church and sit down and pray. I think it's rather like meditation for many of us now. In a sanctuary, it was a place where she could, I suppose, communicate with the deity. Sometimes people have described her religious bent as rather simple, but I wouldn't want to use that kind of word. She did, as many people do, pray for the things that she wanted, to realize her hopes and so on. But in later life, she actually became a student of some rather unusual spiritual traditions and ended up doing the initiation to become a member of the Rosicrucian Order, which must have brought her great comfort because she continued to read in Rosicrucian doctrines seriously to the end of her life. And I was able to talk with some of the people who did that practice with her. So that was very interesting to see that this person who was better known for the vast quantity of love affairs that she had was also someone for whom love in this other sense had great meaning. In fact, I think it was sort of all connected for her.
Mm-hmm. We will come back to the love affairs. But first I wanted to touch upon one of my favorite sections was the passages on World War II and on her activities when she stayed in France and kept singing and how she visited the French prisoners of war in Germany. Can you discuss that time period a bit about what her efforts were during the war?
Oh, yes. I was very, very glad to be able to clarify some of that because there have been doubts about exactly what she did. She did a number of things that required great bravery. Yes, as you said, she did stay in France, first in the south of France, in the unoccupied zone several times, and then in Paris itself, even when the Germans were, fully in charge of everything, because she felt in part that it was her job to go on singing and that she would bring whatever comfort she could to her fans. By then, she was quite well known in France and had great numbers of them. But specifically, what she did that I admire so is that she defied the Nazis, including the German censors who were attending her performances to see what she was singing, by insisting on singing the songs written by her Jewish friends. She had a number of Jewish composers, and she sang their songs even when they became verboten. As the Germans wouldn't allow anything Jewish to be performed or publicized. At one point, she had to step down from an engagement and not sing at all because she refused to give up some of this repertoire. She also paid quite a bit of money to shelter and protect her Jewish friends. Again, some of these composers in the south of France where they took refuge and made complicated arrangements so that they would be safe. But most remarkable was what she did when the German authorities insisted that she, like lots of other entertainers, would have to go to Germany to entertain the French prisoners of war there. Now, truly, that made the Germans look good. It was a good move for German propaganda. Well, she went twice, but with the help of her secretary, who was a member of a resistance unit, made use of these trips to have photographs of herself taken with the prisoners of war. This was looking, you know, the Germans didn't oppose it because it looked like good propaganda again. They smuggled these photographs back, and in a secret dark room of the resistance, some of the their associates printed up these images, blew up the headshots, and made them into fake identity papers, so that when Edith and the secretary went back the second time to Germany, they were able to distribute these fake ID cards along with other helpful items to some of the prisoners, who were then able to escape. And that just took such bravery that it kind of amazes me that they got away with it. But she was staunchly anti-German and wanted very much to help in whatever way she could.
And she did come under some fire after the war, where people didn't understand what she was doing on those trips, right? And she was...
Right.
Yeah.
In the period right after the war, as you can imagine, I think this is the case after many such devastating internecine periods, you know, in which a society is completely torn apart. There were these purge committees at the liberation. Purge committees were set up in all the different professions and circumstances to look into what people actually did, who had collaborated, who had worked with the Germans, and so on. And in many cases, there were severe punishments. Well, there was a purge committee for entertainers. And as it was known that she had gone to Germany to sing, naturally she was called in. But her secretary, who had organized these clandestine activities that helped free the prisoners, went with her and explained everything that happened. So at the end of the hearing, the members of the Purge Committee exonerated Edith Piaf and even issued their congratulations to her for having done what she did.
I want to bring us back to the feral issue and the love affairs. But I think her life is her life is often characterized as wayward, particularly as regards her love affairs. But one thing that struck me in the book was these were not just casual liaisons. They were mutually beneficial relationships. They had meaning. They were with collaborators and friends. Can you talk a bit about her relationships in general, in particular with Marcel Cerdan and their other collaborators that she worked with?
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because that was I cared very, very much to present these love affairs in exactly that way. They often were forms of collaboration based on trust and affinity, and not, you know, mutually beneficial to some extent. They weren't just a bunch of random hookups by any means. So coming back to the people the people you mentioned, the great love of her life, she always said, was the boxer Marcel Cerdan. And the two of them met in the U.S., which is so interesting. Just after the war, they were both in New York in 1947, 48, and perhaps the most famous French people in the U.S. at the time. He had won several incredibly important fights and was a champion, I think middleweight champion, and greatly beloved by his American audiences, even though he was a foreigner. They admired his spirit and they admired the way he boxed. Well, she too had begun to have a very big American following, because after the war, I think the U.S. was ready for somebody as different as she was. And when the two of them fell in love, it was like the biggest romance as far as the French were concerned once they found out. Their American fans were kind of crazy about them, too, when they saw the two together. So this was unfortunately marred by the fact that Chardin was married and had a wife and children back at home. But Piaf was pretty understanding about that and tried to behave in such a way that would not undermine his situation and indeed would protect him from any notoriety until word got out. But to bring the story to its close, she was in New York a couple of years later and knew that he was coming for another fight, but couldn't bear to wait as long as it would take for him to get there because he was planning to come by ship. So she called and said, oh, couldn't you take a plane? And he too must have been eager to get there as fast as he could, so he did. But the terrible tragedy was, as you know, that the plane crashed in the Azores and everyone on board died. She never saw him again. And after that, she was never really the same, according to her closest friends. She began to develop the crippling rheumatoid condition that would plague her the rest of her life, and also felt that she had lost her greatest love. I think they gave each other great confidence and ease, and it truly was a deep love affair. As for the others, in time, it wasn't that she ever got over the loss of Chardin, but being the major star that she was and the kind of person she was, because she was sort of half in love with being in love, she found other collaborators, generally young men. And in the 1950s, quite a few of them were young singers on their way up, who became her proteges or composers or, you know, performed with her. They all benefited tremendously from partnerships with Edith, which often didn't last too long, but were pretty rich while they lasted.
And she also got a lot of excellent songs from them and a lot of, I'm thinking of La Compagnon and her role as mentor to them, but also really increasing their visibility as well.
That's right. It's very interesting to look at that from the inside, from, you know, within the music business, because as you just said, these groups like the Compagnons de la Chanson, the nine young Frenchmen who came over to the U.S. and were so popular after the war, sang with her, she gave them their start. She was tremendously generous with them, wrote them songs, sponsored them, toured with them. And they recognized how much they benefited from their association with her, and she said the same. I spoke to one or two of the members of that group who are still alive.
So by the 1950s, she was in and out of the hospital a lot. What was wrong?
In addition to her arthritic condition, which twisted her fingers and gave her tremendous pain in her limbs, she also suffered in the aftermath of two major car crashes in which she was involved when collaborators were driving. And her pain was such that the doctors whom she saw prescribed various very heavy painkillers, which she tended to take in double and triple doses when she felt she needed them. No one was supervising these various medicines, and so she undoubtedly took far too much. At the same time, from time to time, she drank quite a bit too, as everybody did in those days, but no doubt the combination was pernicious. I should mention that because she was an entertainer, she lived on entertainer's time. That is, she performed late at night, was full of adrenaline, couldn't get to sleep after performances. This is typical of singers, I've learned. And so would probably be up most of the night and have to take sleeping pills to eventually get to sleep in the wee hours of the morning. So this combination of drugs was very damaging to her liver, and eventually, by the late 50s, she was suffering from liver damage and went into what is called technically a hepatic coma, which means that the liver is pretty much shut down. That's what took her to the hospital again and again and eventually caused her death.
I think it's because of these health issues and drug issues that she's often compared to Judy Garland and Billie Holiday. Do you think those comparisons have any merit outside of those reasons?
Well, I think outside of those reasons, yes, because of the passion and go for broke quality of in the voices of all three women. There are huge differences, too, but I would say that another one we could add to that kind of pantheon of singers might be someone like Janis Joplin. There are certain singers, particularly women singers, who just don't hold anything back, who give you their all. And in that sense, I would say the comparison to Judy Garland and Billie Holiday is worth thinking about.
I mentioned a song where she absolutely held nothing back. Can you tell us a little bit about Non, Je ne regrette rien?
Ah, yes. One of my favorite songs, as you can guess from the title. I'll tell you a little bit about my own attachment to that song. When I was a student, again in Paris in 1961, that song was on the radio all the time. It was during the very terrifying years of the Algerian War. And there was, in a sense, a strong connection between the reception of that song and the atmosphere of the time, which was very, very tense. Well, I was living in a kind of dormitory where we had the great virtue of having good plumbing, American-style showers, things like that. And I would sing in the shower, non, je ne regrette rien. There was nowhere else where I could quite bellow it out, but it became my own personal anthem at the time. It was a very difficult time for me, and Edith Piaf in that song kind of saw me through. So I almost felt as if I have it in my bones somehow, but so do a lot of other people. It turns out millions of people took comfort or found courage in that song, and its remarkable declaration of resilience and defiance and the idea that we can start over again even after great sorrow or difficulty, that we can just kind of pick up and start over again without regret. Well, choosing the title just came to me like that, because I thought it also expressed something about Piaf herself, even though she went through so much and suffered so many losses and so much pain. I think she had the kind of life she wanted. I think that she, too, did not regret. She said, in fact, towards the end of her life, that she felt that everything she had gone through gave her the ability to express these things to her audience, to let them know that she shared with them life joys along with its sorrows. And I think people felt that in her voice. I've just done a wonderful program with the BBC about that very song. The BBC's program is called Soul Music. They pick a piece of music which may be classical or popular or anything, which has meant a lot to many, many people, and they go through its history, its composition, its performances, and so on. I was particularly pleased that they chose Non, je ne regrette rien as a way to speak about this as soul music.
Right. It's an extraordinary song. What do you see as Piaf's legacy?
Well, first of all, that her way of performing the full range of the tradition of the French song, which, going back to the ones I mentioned earlier, the realistic song of working class life, we wouldn't have that amazing body of work in the repertoire of one performer had she not become so popular and so successful right up through World War II. But then, in addition to that remarkable group of songs, that which suggests so much about the time in which they were written and the audiences for whom they were performed, there's also her way of taking in what we might now call world music. After she came to the U.S. and toured South America, adapted some very beautiful melodies from Latin American sources, and even made use of rock and roll. Her stunning ability to pick up anything that was interesting, intelligent, new, and fresh musically, and to make something of it in her own way. I think that's a very considerable musical intelligence. That's not exactly a phrase that people often use about her, but I think she had that. And she was also a bit of a poet. But to answer your question more succinctly, she leaves us her legacy, this remarkable spirit coming from next to nothing, coming from her feral beginnings, from the extreme deprivation of her childhood. She never lost touch with her roots. She brought with her everything that she learned under those circumstances, her generosity, her feeling for ordinary people's lives. And she found a way to express all that, our common humanity, the need for love, expressed to everyone that we might run into, regardless of their social class. She expressed all of that in her music, and that's part of what people feel even today and why she has so many millions of fans all over the world.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about No Regrets, the life of Edith Piaf. Any idea what you're going to be writing about next?
Yes. I'm doing something very different. It's a group portrait of four artists whose lives were very much intertwined. I think this may have grown out of the idea of artistic collaboration that you mentioned earlier. How important artists are for each other when they're really in tune and in touch, even if these forms of collaboration are also wrought on occasion. I won't say more than that, but they're American, which is a big change for me. So I'm staying home, so to speak, and writing about people who did not leave the U.S. and run off to Paris like my other subjects, but stayed here and tried to work out what they were going to do with their very American native sources.
How fascinating. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been talking today with Carolyn Burke about her latest biography entitled No Regrets, The Life of Edith Piaf, which is now in hardback. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books and Biography. Thanks for listening.